Keeping Democracy Alive with Bert Cohen.
Check for pulse.
Stand clear. Push to shock.
So yes, there's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy. That people don't feel that they can do very much.
You know what this is? This is a very Hamiltonian system. Alexander Hamilton being the guy here in a very un-Jeffersonian.
In the case of the Republicans, it's dramatically the opposite. But even in the case of the Democrats.
An absolute typhoon of terror against African Americans in the South.
America's fascists are those people who think that Wall Street comes first and the American people come second.
We're really seen as a financial sector that's gotten out of hand.
The shooting, the violence, that is not the drug problem. That is, in fact, the drug policy problem.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
And there has been a lot of fire, a lot of death. What this country has gone through, this nation, or perhaps group of nations, history is always up for reanalysis. We're going to talk today about the American Civil War, which technically doesn't appear to be a civil war because it wasn't two sides fighting to control one government. No, it was a war of secession that, unlike the War of Secession from England, was not successful. But I'm very pleased to have with us Richard Slotkin, author of the award-winning American history trilogy, Regeneration Through Violence, The Fatal Environment, and Gunfighter Nation. Richard Slotkin is Professor Emeritus of English at Wesleyan University. The new book is The Long Road to Antietam. Professor Slotkin, thanks very much for being with us on The Bert Cohen Show. It's quite a book.
Thank you very much.
The Long Road to Antietam is not just a narrative of the battle, an incredible battle. More importantly, it's a fresh interpretation that reminds us that the context for the tactical decisions was a struggle between President Lincoln and General George McClellan. That struggle between the two egos was very, very significant, and there was a lot of death caused, perhaps as a result of that personal struggle. Professor Slotkin argues that after Antietam, which happened 150 years ago, to be precise, it was clear that there would be no compromise settlement between the North and South. Compromise was impossible. After the Battle of Antietam, the struggle became a total war, putting civilians as well as soldiers in harm's way. McClellan remained convinced, along with many in the North, many Democrats in particular, that the best path to reunion involved the conciliation of Southern slaveholders. Well, in the earliest days of the war, Lincoln told the Southern states he would not interfere with slavery as an institution. Only later did he understand the depth of commitment Southerners felt toward their nation. Professor Slotkin, what was the originally understood purpose of the war against the South? And what made the shift away from a strategy of conciliation to a war of subjugation? What made that occur? So what was the original purpose?
The original idea on both sides was that if they could win a few early victories, and if the other side experienced the heavy economic costs of a war, that they would soon be willing to compromise. And the problem was that by the time the secession movement had been in charge of the South for 3 or 4 months, the commitment of the Southern people to the cause of independence had become substantial. It was no longer a movement led by a radical minority, but it had aroused some strong popular support. Similarly, in the North, the support for the Union was surprising to the South. The Southerners thought that the Union was a kind of legal abstraction that nobody really cared about. And yet, when Lincoln called for volunteers, they came swarming to the recruiting stations, many more than he could initially deal with. So each side underrated the commitment of the other to its cause. And what had happened during the first year was that the Union mounted offensives, partly on land, partly amphibious attacks using the Navy, all around the periphery of the Confederacy. And they really kind of knocked the Confederates off their pins for about 6 months and shocked the Confederate government with the strength of their attacks. And then the strength of the attacks in the West kind of petered out because there was just too much territory to control given the size of the army that the Union had raised. And in the East, the big army under General McClellan was defeated by another army under Robert E. Lee in a battle, in 7 days' battles in front of Richmond.
Right.
And so by July 1st, 1862, what you had was essentially a military standoff.
Mm-hmm.
The North had made what a wrestler would call a bull rush and nearly knocked the South off, but didn't quite get it done. And then the South had gathered its strength and rallied and held its ground and now had stopped the Northern offensive cold. And you have a moment of balance when both sides have to rethink what it is their objectives are and how it is they're going to achieve them.
It would appear to me that Southern soldiers clearly knew what they were fighting for. And there was some dissension in the North about the war against the South, the war against secession. Certainly there were the Copperheads, the Democrats who wanted to reconcile with the South. But if you asked a random Union soldier what they were fighting for, what do you think he would have told you?
They would have said Union, first and foremost. But they would have added something like liberty or freedom, which vaguely associated themselves with the idea that slavery was a bad thing. They were not by any means unanimous about abolition.
Right.
There was a kind of general agreement that slavery was certainly not for them, probably not for the new Western territories that they were just beginning to settle, which is why Lincoln's party won the election. But they would have said Union, first and foremost, Union and freedom, for Lincoln and liberty too.
Lincoln and liberty too. And the South, of course, was fighting for their independence, for their way of life.
Now, it's interesting. Both sides would have said something political. The South would have said independence and states' rights. And the North would have said Union and liberty. And hidden on both sides is the, what is the degree of their commitment to slavery? And in the North, there's a very strong anti-slavery sentiment, let me call it, that doesn't necessarily amount to a belief that slavery should be abolished immediately or that blacks should have civil rights if they ever were freed. And in the South, there's also a question of how committed the Southern masses are to the preservation of slavery. One of the questions that's going to become important, not in 1862, but a year or so down the road, is the question whether poor whites want to continue fighting for the preservation of slavery, and whether it might not be better policy on the part of the Southern government to concede some ground on giving up slavery in order to win wider political support at home and foreign support abroad. So there's division on both sides about this, more so in the North.
We are talking on the Bert Cohen Show with author Richard Slotkin about his new book, The Long Road to Antietam, which occurred 150 years ago. And certainly it appears that one of the intentions of President Lincoln in issuing the Emancipation Proclamation was, which happened in 1862 as well, after the Battle of Antietam, that he wanted to encourage some divisions in the South between the farmers who really didn't have slaves and the planter class. So to have kind of a class war and to destabilize the South that way. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I think that's true. It's a complex decision that he makes, and maybe it would be a good thing to realize that it's a decision which is made in three different stages. As soon as Lincoln realizes that his offensives have failed, he realizes that he's looking at a much longer war, which is not only going to require more troops, but it's going to require a different way of fighting. And in early July, he begins thinking that he's going to have to attack slavery directly in some way. Not entirely clear what that way is going to be. For example, one of the ways he could have done it is to simply say that as the army advanced, it would confiscate the slave property.
Right.
Of people who were actively involved in serving either in the Confederate government or the Confederate Army, which would have been a very limited and targeted emancipation just at those people who were openly in rebellion, participating in the rebellion against the government.
Right.
I mean, that wouldn't have strained the law much at all to do that. But Lincoln thinks a little more deeply about this, and he's thinking in two ways. As you were just saying, He knows that slavery is the basis of the Southern economy.
Right.
If you want to weaken the South's ability to produce goods and food and cotton for world trade, you have to attack slavery. And if you attack slavery, then you change the question for the Southern poor white. The question now becomes, are you fighting for independence or are you fighting for other men's slaves?
Right.
And in fact, there will be many Southern poor whites who say, there's an actual quote, I'm tired of fighting for other men's Negroes. So there is that thought in his mind. But on an even deeper level than that, Lincoln believes that slavery is, first of all, a moral evil. But most of all, he says that the only basis for civil war in the United States, the only reason that Americans would fall out with each other, is over this question of slavery. So if the war were to be settled by a compromise that left slavery intact, all it would do is postpone the Civil War for another generation. It would have to be fought all over again. You're not going to be able to get away from it. And so he thinks, if I have to fight this bigger, costlier, more terrible war, the only way I can really justify that is if I remove it, that one of my war objectives will be to remove the basic cause of the conflict. And so, you know, if we win, we'll not only have union, but we'll also have peace. We won't have this slavery instigating conflict among us ever again. And so that's why he decides early in July that he's going to issue an Emancipation Proclamation,
right,
freeing all slaves in rebel territory, not slaves in pro-union slave states like Kentucky and Maryland,
right,
and not slaves in areas that are now controlled by the Union Army.
I think there's universal recognition by virtually all the historians about the American Civil War that it didn't start out as a war to free the slaves. We certainly, you know, that's what we were all told in elementary school, but it was to really to hold the Union together. But the proclamation was, frankly, a military tactic to weaken the opposition.
Yes, as it finally emerged, and now in the first stage of things, the first draft of the proclamation was presented to Lincoln's cabinet on July 22nd, 3 months before it was acted, but the Battle of Antietam occurred.
Right.
And in that first version, he made no mention of taking blacks into the military.
Mm-hmm.
He had a huge, long paragraph in which he said that the slaves freed by the proclamation would be sent to a foreign country, would be sent back to Africa,
right,
or to the Caribbean.
Right.
It took the slaves, but it was otherwise a very conservative document. And as he was forced to postpone issuing it, because he needed to wait till the Federal armies won a victory,
mm-hmm,
because if he didn't, then it would just look like he was acting out of desperation instead of out of carefully considered moral and political principles. So he has to wait and hold off. And while he's waiting, his ideas get more radical. So that when the proclamation finally comes out, the idea of sending blacks overseas is reduced to one sentence. And it's really just in there as kind of a sop to the conservatives in his cabinet. It's really basically an empty idea by that point. Frees all the slaves in rebel territories and does two more things which are really, truly revolutionary. The first is, he says that blacks freed by the proclamation should not indulge in any violence. It is that they shouldn't go kill their masters. He doesn't want to be charged with inciting a slave rebellion. He says they shouldn't use violence except in necessary self-defense.
Yeah.
And what's radical about that is that according to the law of slavery, that is a law that runs a plantation and a slave state, slaves have no right of self-defense.
Well,
master
that
punishes you or abuses you and you're a slave, it's tough.
Right.
You can't resist. So Lincoln is, in that phrase, just blowing up the whole basis of discipline on the plantation.
Well, I'm reminded.
The second thing he does is he says blacks freed by the act, by the proclamation, will be accepted into the United States military. And the right to participate in the defense of the country is a major civil right, which blacks, even freed blacks, were not granted in the free states. And now Lincoln is saying they'll be taken into the federal army. And in fact, they are taken in. About 180,000 blacks will serve in the Union Army, which is a little bit less than 10% of the total 2 million total troops enrolled during the whole course of the war. But all of the blacks are enrolled in the last 2 years, when the white enlistment rate is much lower, only between 700,000 and 1 million. So we're talking about blacks amounting to something like 15% of the effective strength of the Union Army in the last 2 years of the war. They could not have won the war without the black troops.
So as a military commander, a commander-in-chief, the president certainly knew what he was talking about.
Oh, yes.
And the whole role of the commander-in-chief at the time, as I understand from your book, was not at all well-defined. It was very unclear as to, you know, what a commander-in-chief really was, which, you know, it certainly brings up there was this other ego involved, a fellow by the name of McClellan, who certainly it seemed that, I mean, your book reveals a lot about General McClellan, that he kind of felt that he was, you know, a de facto commander-in-chief, if not de jure commander-in-chief. He was loved by his troops, but became despised by President Lincoln. How much of the there's so much to talk about. How much of a factor in Lincoln's call for all-out war was Lincoln's frustration with General McClellan and his conciliatory stance?
Well, it's a major factor in everything having to do with war policy. And so far as emancipation is concerned, his disagreement with McClellan in early July of 1862 actually does precipitate his decision to act on the idea of an emancipation proclamation.
Mm-hmm.
But just to step back a minute to what you said first about commander-in-chief, it's true that the notion of the president as commander-in-chief has never been tested before like this in American history. There are only two major wars that they have as precedent for that. One is the War of 1812, which there's such a small regular army. There are so many. It's such a militia-based war. And communications across the country are so thin or so slow that it's very difficult for the president to exercise anything like supervision or direct control of his far-flung military forces. He gives orders. The orders are obeyed in a general kind of way, but commanders in the field have a lot of autonomy.
Sure.
And the other war is the Mexican War, which is, 3,000 miles, 4,000 miles away from Washington. The president sends out his orders. God knows when they'll get to the general in the field. Winfield Scott, who commanded in Mexico, was actually negotiating for peace without authorization from the White House.
Right.
So there really is no precedent for commander-in-chief. Now you have a war, which is a civil war, which is at the gates of Washington,
mm-hmm.
which involves armies that are by an order of magnitude greater in size than any army that the United States has ever raised before. Scott's army in Mexico was maybe 30,000 men. The army, the one army in front of Washington is 130,000. And there were four other armies, major field armies, on the Union side. So it's really just orders of magnitude difference, and it's right at the gates. It's right local. It's right at the doorstep. So at the opening, the Senate tries to take control of the war away from the president. They fail, and then they have a proposal to make McClellan what's called a dictator.
Yes.
And the idea here is, not a military coup, but they would pass a law giving McClellan or some chosen general temporary control over all matters having to do with military policy. and essentially reducing Lincoln to a figurehead so far as military policy was concerned. And Lincoln blocks that. And by blocking that, he really, in a sense, creates the basis for this notion that the president really, really is the commander-in-chief. And he's the top of the chain of command, and there's just no substitute for that role. But, of course, McClellan doesn't give up on the possibility that he might somehow get back into that role. And the reason he does that is twofold. First of all, he has a complete contempt for Lincoln.
Yes.
McClellan's a total snob, and he thinks Lincoln's a rube and a bungler. He calls him the original gorilla, a well-meaning baboon. And the other reason is that McClellan is a passionate partisan Democrat.
Yes.
Who had supported Stephen Douglas against Lincoln in that great senatorial contest, Lincoln-Douglas debate,
mm-hmm.
and in the election, and who had become, by 1862, the symbolic leader of the Democratic Party in the country, even though he was a serving officer in the U.S. military. All of the Southern Democrats, the leaders of the party, were now with the Confederacy, and the great Northern leader, Stephen Douglas, was dead. And basically, they've got no one but McClellan to turn to. So McClellan sees himself as the embodiment, the voice of conservative democratic principles in Washington, and he engages in a struggle against the Republicans in Lincoln's cabinet for control of war policy by various means from start to finish.
And apparently, not only was there antipathy between Lincoln and McClellan, but between Secretary of War Edwin Stanton. Tell us about that a little bit and its significance on the conduct of the war.
Yeah, the Stanton story is very, very interesting because Stanton and McClellan were originally bosom buddies.
That changed.
And they plotted to get Stanton made Secretary of War, replacing Simon Cameron as the original Secretary of War, in part so that McClellan would have a free hand in using the army the way he saw fit. But as soon as Stanton gets into the office of Secretary of War,
mm-hmm.
he flips.
Yes.
And he becomes McClellan's severest critic. He thinks McClellan's too slow, too cautious, not willing to act in a timely manner to attack the Confederates. And his motives are a little hard to follow there. I think that one thing certainly is true. He was a passionate devotee of the cause of the Union. And once he was in office, he realized McClellan was just not willing to do the job in the way
right.
it needed to be done. And so he turns against McClellan. And it may also be that he wanted to make sure that now that McClellan knew that he, Stanton, was in charge, not McClellan, because now Stanton had the office. So between ambition and principle, Stanton becomes McClellan's enemy.
Ambition, ego. I believe it was
ambition, ego. Yeah, and principle. It's very hard to disentangle the two here.
Well, I'm reminded of a quote attributed to Harry Truman a little bit later in the presidency, who said, "It's amazing how much it can get done if you don't care who gets the credit." Well, there were some significant egos at work here. And I wonder if McClellan was reflecting what, as you point out, many in the North, quote, doubted the constitutionality of Lincoln's plan to coerce the seceding states.
Yes.
And questioned the wisdom and or morality of trying to pin the Union together with bayonets. That was an interesting observation. Questioning,
yes.
and it seemed, did McClellan reflect that questioning whether the Union should be pinned together with bayonets?
Yes and no. He definitely is a pro-war Democrat. He knows that the war has to be fought. There's a very fine distinction here, though. In fact, it's so fine that that Lincoln rightly regarded as essentially meaningless over this question of the word subjugation. Subjugation implied that not only did the rebellion have to be put down, but that when the rebels were defeated, the political entities, the state, their governments would be regarded as completely invalid and would have to be reconstructed in some way by the conquering Union forces. That's what subjugation is. It's putting under someone else's law. And McClellan denied that Congress or the president had the power to do that. So that, in effect, what he's saying is that as you reconquer parts of the South, they almost automatically come back into the Union and begin to and recover their political rights. And a moment's thought will let you see how absurd that is, because what you're saying is that that people who are Confederate sympathizers get to vote on whether or not to continue the war for the Union, and it makes no sense. And it also really does undermine the whole notion that you can use force to suppress the rebellion. So Lincoln rejects that position. But again, the reason why, I mean, McClellan is not a lawyer. The reason why he reaches for this legal doctrine is because he is a white supremacist. He believes passionately that slavery must be preserved, and that the only way to restore the Union as it was is with slavery. He does not want free blacks running around the country. He uses the N-word freely to talk about them. And he's very frank about this. It's not something he has to apologize for, in certainly not in private correspondence.
Well, isn't it?
He wants to keep the blacks in slavery. So the question then is, how can he preserve Lincoln's original policy of conciliation when all of the politics in the North is pushing Lincoln towards abolition in one form or another? And I have to just, you know, step away from Lincoln and McClellan for a second. Northerners, by 1862, the summer, are furious with the South. They've killed all these people. They've ruined the country. They've wrecked the economy for what? For a meaningless dispute over slavery in the Western territories and to make an attack on the sacred principle of the union of the nation. And in their anger at the South, even some very conservative newspaper editors are willing to punish Southerners by taking their slaves away. Now, they don't want a general emancipation, but they're interested in punishment. And McClellan realizes that, you know, unless he can defeat the Republicans and gain control of the administration, his pro-slavery principles are going to be defeated.
Well, as I understand it, the word racism didn't even exist in the 19th century. In fact, you had populist progressives like William Jennings Bryan, Theodore Roosevelt, and others who were openly what we called, we would now see as racist and white supremacist. It seems like that was simply, absolutely, by far, the majority opinion throughout the country.
Yes. The question is, everybody believes in it. Even people like Frederick Douglass, a great black abolitionist, have a notion of race. And what they mean by that is this, that the human race is divided into distinct, let's call them biosocial groups. Because there's a kind of a fudge factor there. And these distinct groups, we would call them ethnic groups,
right,
have particular characteristics or gifts. And the question is, are they all capable of self-government? Can they all, could they all, in a democratic society, play the role of political citizens in the proper way? And on that question, there are two distinct schools of thought. Lincoln belongs to the prevailing school of thought, which holds, yes, even blacks have innately, as human beings, as the Declaration of Independence says, not only the right to self-government, but the ability to do it. What Lincoln and other conservative anti-slavery people say is, but can they do it in the United States? Because the idea of racial nationalism is that every race, every people, deserves its own nation.
Uh-huh.
Okay, the American nation is the nation of the white race, of white Northern Europeans, let's say.
Christians at that.
But in this period, you could probably say white British Isles and North Germany, white people, and mainly British Isles people.
Right.
It's our nation,
yep.
that way.
Yep.
Blacks can have their own nation. They just can't have it here. but they are capable of it. And what that means is this, for someone like Lincoln, that they're entitled to certain, not political rights, but to economic rights and to freedom in an economic sense while they are resident in the country. And it, to us, it seems a queer notion that you should be considered a citizen and not have political rights. But remember, in the 1800s, women are what? 50% of the society,
sure.
White women,
right?
And they don't have political rights.
No rights.
But they are citizens. They have property rights. So what Lincoln is saying, what the let's call them the conservative abolitionists are saying is, yeah, you know, we're against slavery. We think it can be abolished. We're not entirely sure that it's safe to have such a huge ethnic minority in this country. We'd rather they emigrated to Africa or the Caribbean. We'd like to encourage them to do that. But the truth is, we don't have to give up this ultimate idea of equality. The counter to that is a Southern-based counter. The South, Southern intellectuals, produce an alternative theory of race, which says that black people are distinct among the races of the world, or at least the races with which they are familiar, in that they are not capable of self-government. And in fact, Alexander Stevens, who's the vice president of the Confederacy mm-hmm. and the major author of the Confederate Constitution, in a speech which is called the Cornerstone Speech, he says the cornerstone of our Confederacy is the principle that Thomas Jefferson was wrong when he said all men were created equal. The cornerstone principle of the Confederacy is the understanding that the Negro is inferior racially, that the inferiority is permanent, unchangeable, and that the only proper condition for the Negro, so long as he resides in the United States, is the condition of slavery.
Well, isn't it true that a lot of people in the North, frankly, agreed with that at the time?
Yes, it is true. And I would say that McClellan and his and the Democrats that he spoke for is part of that, absolutely. And it's hard to judge exactly, but you know, we don't have public opinion polls to
right.
deal with.
Right.
But if you look at the 1864 presidential election, which was contested essentially by the Democrats on a platform of white supremacy and ending the war, so that race was one of the most prominent elements of their campaign. Even though the war, Lincoln had clearly succeeded in bringing the Union close to victory, mm-hmm. 45% of Northerners voted for McClellan.
That's pretty.
So that gives you some sense of what the dimensions of this hostility to even a conditional notion of black freedom was in the North.
We are talking with Professor Richard Slotkin, author of the new book, The Long Road to Antietam, which was a clear dividing line in the Civil War. My understanding was that Antietam was a strategic offensive initiated by the South. They were bringing the war to the North. The war had caused massive the devastation was just really beginning throughout the Confederacy, but they tried to bring it to the North. What was their political purpose in bringing it to Antietam, which is, I believe, in Maryland? And, you know, after that, Lincoln used it as the victory to hang his new sudden radical twist to the war. But what was the South trying to do with their, you know, General Lee was a powerful, much respected general, and McClellan turned him back, and Lincoln was a little bit displeased, shall we say, that McClellan allowed Lee to escape, and McClellan did not pursue and destroy the army. But what was the Lee's goal in making the invasion in Antietam?
Well, the Confederacy at this point also realizes they've got to change what they're doing. And one of the key things to bear in mind here is that the North was going to hold midterm congressional elections
in
November.
Up. Mm-hmm.
So the Confederacy has, in July, an opportunity to go on the offensive.
Yes.
Because the Northern offenses have been stalled. And so they Jefferson Davis and his generals stage a grand offensive by four different armies, stretching all the way from northern Mississippi through Tennessee and into Kentucky, and then Lee going north into Maryland. And they're hoping that if they can win victories in Kentucky and in Maryland, they might be able to pry those slave states away from the Union. So that's the first objective. But Lee's objective in particular is to get into Maryland and establish a fairly long-term presence there. If he can do that, first of all, he may draw Maryland sympathizers
sure.
to the Confederate cause.
Yeah, it was up for
but
grabs.
It would also severely embarrass the Lincoln administration on the eve of these congressional elections. And if he can do that, even if he doesn't win a decisive victory, all he has to do is hang around in western Maryland and southern Pennsylvania or southwestern Pennsylvania for a month or so. He can turn the election against Lincoln, and he might even be able then to win foreign recognition for the Confederacy
right.
from the British and the French.
Right. That might have made a huge, huge difference. As you point out, both Lincoln and Davis, both presidents, started out with a, quote, wish that the conflict could be resolved by some kind of compromise that would preserve the values and social order each man valued. But with the Emancipation Proclamation, which came after the Battle at Antietam, Lincoln was well aware that compromise was suddenly out of the question. The effect of such a proclamation would be to make a compromise peace impossible and commit the Union to a war of subjugation. Could there not have been, as many wanted, some sort of compromise? Subjugation, boy, that has long-term ramifications, as we saw yeah. well into the 20th century.
Yeah, it does. I think the answer to the question is no. The only way to restore the possibility of compromise with the South after the proclamation is issued is for something to happen that would force Lincoln to take it back. And I think that's what the Democrats are hoping for if they can get control of Congress in the midterm elections, which they fail to do because mm-hmm. Lee loses the Battle of Antietam.
Right.
And the other possibility is that the Democrats could win the presidential election of 1864, and one of their platform planks is to rescind the Emancipation Proclamation, put things back to where they had been, in 1861-62, and see if they couldn't get a compromise settlement on that basis.
I thought it was interesting, as you point out, that just before the Battle of Antietam, Lincoln reportedly made a vow, a covenant, that if God gave us the victory in the approaching battle, he would consider it an indication of divine will, and that was his duty to move forward in the matter of emancipation. Professor, isn't it a little dangerous when a political leader cites divine will as guiding his policies, and does that not then become a holy war, a jihad, which is incredibly bloody? I mean, he had this divine mission here?
Well, I think we have to make allowances for the political and language of Americans in that time, that they're an intensely religious people. Even Lincoln, whose religion is not a really conventional kind of Christianity, has a belief in a universe which is ruled by divine providence.
Mm.
Lincoln's idea of divine providence is it's a somewhat more inscrutable providence than McClellan's, which is much more conventional. But they all speak the language of divine favor, divine providence, God's will.
Well, did Lincoln?
So to say jihad is to say that each side assumes that the other is not Christian. And while there are some people who do indeed think that way, I don't think that's the predominant mood. But I think that Lincoln realizes that what he's doing is revolutionary. And he's looking for something. He's looking for a sign. He's hoping for a sign. I think, though, just speaking personally,
sure,
I have my doubts about that whole divine providence thing, because he had first decided to issue the Emancipation Proclamation months before, July 22nd.
Mm-hmm.
He had been working on it for a week or so. I'm revising it for a week or so before he brought it into the room. I can't doubt that he knew that whatever happened, he was, you know, that if he got any kind of victory out of McClellan, mm-hmm. he was going to use the Emancipation Proclamation.
Yeah, he was going to use that.
And he had already said that he was waiting for a victory to do it for political reasons. So I think it's just partly the language of the time is to put everything in terms of a reliance on God and signs from God.
So I guess we can't really know for sure, but there has been concern that Lincoln somehow felt that he had this direct connection with the divine, with God will, and that, you know.
It's actually McClellan who feels it. McClellan, everything that McClellan does, even when McClellan lost to General Lee in the 7 days battles at Richmond, he said, now he sees that the hand of divine providence in this. If he had won the battle, the victory would have benefited the Republicans and made the restoration of the Union with slavery impossible. So it was divine will that was guiding him. And when he was put back in command by Lincoln for the Battle of Antietam, it was divine providence allowing him to triumph over his evil enemies. Lincoln has a meditation on the divine will that he writes in a notebook right before, about a couple of weeks before Antietam, in which he says that the divine will is a puzzle to him, that both sides pray to the same God, that God could have given the victory to either side before this, but for some reason which Lincoln cannot quite fathom, God has decided to let the struggle go on. And it's a puzzle to him what God might mean or intend by this. And perhaps with great trouble and great intellectual effort, in the ensuing days, he became convinced that the reason God had postponed victory to this point was because God wanted him to free the slaves. There's a difference in style here, a difference between a man who, McClellan is kind of a narcissist, a kind of an egomaniac, who believes that God's on his side no matter what. And Lincoln is a guy who is troubled about his relation to God and whether or not he's doing the will of God. And so he worries about it. He puzzles over it with humility.
Well, there certainly were a lot of differences between Lincoln and McClellan, that's for sure. And one that, Lincoln was rather displeased that McClellan did not go after and destroy Lee's army. My sense is, from reading the book, that McClellan was certainly a warrior. He was a commander, but that he wanted to limit it to military losses. And it seems that after the Battle of Antietam and the Emancipation Proclamation, that suddenly we had a new war that under President Lincoln, inflicting great loss and suffering on civilian populations, was suddenly an instrument of policy.
Yeah.
The consequences of Lincoln concluding that the rebellion must be punished and not merely suppressed, we heard similar sentiments after the Germans in the Great War, known as the First World War, and we know what that led to. The Germans were punished, and because of that, there was this tremendous, that was the Second World War, and had they just merely been suppressed and not punished, who knows? But we know what that led to now. I wonder if such a sentiment that it must be punished and not merely suppressed led directly to the redemption movement in the conquered states and led directly to many, many decades of unbelievable terrorism against African Americans. So is it not possible that this new notion of all-out war, inflicting great loss and suffering on civilian populations as an instrument of policy, made things a heck of a lot worse for the blacks in the southern part of America?
No, I think that's pushing it too far. That is putting too much on this one action. The question of punishment after the Union was restored was a question that Lincoln never got to deal with. And his own inclination was not to punish. His own inclination was to restore political rights to those Southerners who were willing to take an oath of loyalty to the Union and to agree to abide by the slaves having been freed by the Emancipation Proclamation, is they had to accept both the Union and the Proclamation in order to have their civil rights restored. That's not that wasn't punitive at all.
I'm sure a lot of people in the South kind of saw it as punitive.
Well, the punishment was the war. The punishment was the destruction of life and property that brought things to the position where, in order to get your rights back, you had to take an oath of loyalty to the Union and accept the Emancipation Proclamation. The South destroyed, you know, the South rebelled against the government.
Yes.
Violently against the government and caused a civil war. To expect them to get away scot-free,
well,
that I think is absurd. But but Lincoln's idea was to restrict the punishment to simply that which the war itself made inescapable. And once the war was over and the issue was settled, to restore the civil rights of Southerners as rapidly as was consistent with public safety. That is, you don't want to restart the Confederacy, but you do want people who are willing to accept the verdict of the battlefield to recover their civil rights. And Lincoln's notion was to persuade the Southerners to grant civil rights of some sort to the freed slaves or to some freed slaves. He proposed in Louisiana that the vote be given to the slaves who freed slaves who had served in the Union armies, or to the most intelligent and educated members of the slave population. So he was willing to negotiate with Southerners who accepted the Union on as to what the terms of abolition would be in the South. And his death just knocked all of that completely out.
Well, it certainly gave rise to the redemption movement in which Southern whites, after the oppressive Reconstruction had been overturned, the redemption movement caused a tremendous, tremendous violence against blacks. And I have to say, I think, you know, to just state blanketly that the South started the Civil War, that is certainly an arguable position, because there's a lot of people still, I'm sure. I mean, the Civil War resolved, well, militarily the North won, but many people now say, well, they didn't fire a shot. It was the North who invaded the South. It was the North who made war on the South and simply didn't let them go. Certainly many in the South, they just wanted to be let go. Just to, I was looking for a quote here. I can't find it. You know, just let us be. They wanted to do that. And
all we ask is to be left alone.
Yes. Thank you.
I tell you the truth. I tell you the truth. This is a very complex issue.
It is.
Our views on both sides. My own view is that the South started it. That if they had believed in the possibility of a peaceful secession, they could have negotiated the surrender of Fort Sumter instead of firing on it. But they knew from the start that what they were doing was a revolution. It was not a legal act. And they believed, the leadership believed, as General Beauregard said, that if the Confederacy is not baptized in blood, it won't last 6 months. So they knew what they were doing, and I just don't buy that. And states' rights, there are only two rights, so-called states' rights, that the North ever challenged. One was the right to take slavery into the territories, which is not a state's right, it's actually an individual right, and which could be settled by negotiation if the South had been willing. And the other was the right of secession, which the North said was no right. Lincoln said, "You have, you know, as human beings, you have the right of revolution if you don't like the government, but you can't claim that it's a legal act. It's a revolution." And so, so I put the blame on. I mean, the North had to agree to fight, and that is a different issue. It does take two to make a war. But all I'm trying to say here is that, from Lincoln's perspective, given that the war is engaged, given that he's fighting a war to restore the Union, he wants to restore the Union, and that restoring the war to the Union requires the destruction of slavery and of property and life in the South in the way that it does. He just doesn't want it to go beyond the war. He wants to have some settlement afterwards which people can live with.
The failure
of Reconstruction,
yes,
which leads to redemption,
yes,
is really beyond the scope of my book.
Right.
And it's really beyond the scope of Lincoln's career. There's a very, very good book by Eric Foner called Reconstruction, The Unfinished Revolution, which I think has the best history of that period that has been written.
Well, I have to read that, too. I also recommend America Aflame, quite a good book. Now, you say that it was not just a war. That's one of the points of your book here. But it was indeed a revolution which, as you say, altered in fundamental ways the social forms and psychology of race relations in the region. And that Lincoln also would inaugurate a social revolution with class and race consequences far more like those of, say, the French or Russian revolutions. But those revolutions were legitimate revolutions that were initiated from the bottom up. Lincoln's revolution was imposed from above. What kind of revolution is imposed from top down? What kind of revolution is that when the people of the South, except, of course, for the significant population of the enslaved people, how can a revolution be imposed from the top down? I've never heard of a revolution like that.
They all work that way. I mean, in the sense that you don't get a spontaneous uprising of the masses. You get a political leadership group that has a program and takes the initiative and sets the ball rolling. The Southern Revolution was a revolution led by the political leadership of the South, and the Northern response to that revolution was a counter-revolutionary measure, which was led by the political leadership of the North. Where the masses of people come into it is, do they back the initiative taken by their leaders?
And they didn't.
Or do they fail to back it? Do they let the leaders hang out there by themselves? And in both cases, the Southern masses backed their revolutionary leadership.
Yes.
And the Northern masses ultimately backed Lincoln's leadership.
But the Southerners certainly didn't back the revolution that came down on them at the force of a bayonet.
No. But I think we're quibbling about a word here. What I meant was that the change which the Emancipation Proclamation began revolutionized Southern society in the sense that it changed it completely. And I think you have to admit that it changed it completely.
No, I don't agree.
Okay.
I think, as we saw, there's a huge evidence that for many, many, many decades going into the 1950s and 60s, that the reaction against the change made things a lot worse. I mean, but
slavery existed in the South for what, 200 some odd years?
Yes.
And after 1865, it was gone.
Well, not completely, of course.
And blacks had for decades before the right was taken away, political rights in the South. It was what Foner calls an unfinished revolution.
Yes.
But it was a radical, radical change.
Yes, it certainly was. And it's a fascinating book, and we've reached the end of the hour. I'd love to talk about it more. And I have to quote Bob Dylan, who said recently, just very recently, if slavery had been given up in a more peaceful way, America would be far ahead today. This is the only country to defeat slavery by a war, as far as I know.
Yeah, well, there's no doubt about that.
Fascinating book. It's called The Long Road to Antietam. Richard Slotkin, thank you very much for being with us. And the discussion about the American Civil War goes on and on and on. And certainly the Battle of Antietam changed the war to absolute, total, all-out war against not just military troops, but there was no mercy on the civilians as well. Thank you very much for listening.
Out for the first, atmosphere's heavy. World title lays on the line. Strong and proud, he is much older. I'm the faster, I'm in my prime. Third round late, he starts to tire. Open cut over his left eye.
smelling blood, attack is relentless. In the box seats, I see his girl cry. Put him away, don't let him recover. Someone's eyes drill holes in my head. It is his proud, determined mother. His eyes are flooded, God, he can't even see. I've hunted this title, but now it don't seem right. I fight back tears while I destroy his life.